Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, but it's a double-barreled crazy with actually some good news, so make sure you stay tuned for that. Jim, let's start with the good, and this is qualified good, but given what we've seen in past election cycles, this is actually pretty good news. The moderators have been announced for the three presidential debates coming up in September and October, as well as the vice presidential debate. Lester Holt of NBC will moderate the first one. That's not necessarily great news. Anderson Cooper and Martha Raddatz will co-moderate the second debate, which will be town hall style. That's in St. Louis on October 9th. But Chris Wallace of Fox News, the host of Fox News Sunday, will moderate the third and final presidential debate at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas on October 19th. Elaine Quijano will moderate the vice presidential debate October 4th in Farmville, Virginia. So, Jim, most of those are standard network people who clearly have a tilt to the left. But Chris Wallace is a pretty great choice here. I don't think that anyone from Fox News has ever been picked to do a general election debate. We know from what we saw from him in the primary season and from previous cycles that he'll be perfectly tough, but pretty fair, too.
The reputation of Fox News is that it's Republican TV, it's conservative TV, it's biased in favor of the GOP, and I'm sure there are a lot of Republicans who'd be like, no, I don't feel that way. Probably every one of Donald Trump's rivals says, boy, that came to an end real fast. but, you know, Chris Wallace has always been a straight shooter who asks tough questions of everybody. My suspicion is that there have been quite a few Democratic lawmakers who have said, oh, I'm not going to do Fox News. I won't go on Fox News Sunday. Ah, they're biased, when they really just want to avoid the tough questions. So it's good to see Chris Wallace getting the spotlight here. Looks like probably do a good job. And on the rest of the list, we were chewing this over on the writer's conference call this morning. Greg, does Martha Raddatz count as liberal and left of center, or just general all-around smug? I'm trying to think back when she moderated the vice presidential debate last time, and everybody remembers Joe Biden cackling and smiling wildly like he was Jack Nicholson in Batman playing the Joker. I don't remember Raddatz's questions being seen as really skewed to one side or something like that. People argue about whether she's the ideal host of this week or something like that, but I think this is, from where we're sitting, probably about as good a quartet or as you're going to find. The only what's kind of pleasing about this, Greg, is no return of Candy Crowley, who managed to say, no, Obama's totally right on this, on a point that Mitt Romney was actually right. I think the single biggest error ever made by a debate moderator in the history of American presidential debates. And it's good to see she has not been invited back. She really should be kind of hanging her head in shame over that.
Yeah, wherever she is. She's not at CNN anymore, so I'm not even sure where she works these days. But to be fair to Candy Crowley, while she made a huge mistake in front of tens of millions of people after the debate when there were about 15,000 people watching on CNN, she admitted that she had made a mistake. So that totally made up for it. But there will be a CNN figure at that town hall debate, Anderson Cooper. He was actually fairly solid, I thought, in the Democratic debate. His first question to Hillary Clinton in the first debate was, after going through all of her flip-flops, is, will you say anything to get elected? So she might get some tough questions from him as well.
I think we can all think of a whole lot of people who would be worse than these moderators. So, you know.
Definitely.
That qualifies as the good martini today.
Yes, yes. And one of them is a bona fide non-liberal. Let's move on to the bad martini now and the sordid story of the Clinton Foundation and its web of entanglement with the State Department during the years of Hillary Clinton. Just keeps coming. This is from Jim today in the Morning Jolt. Where did the Clinton Foundation end and the State Department begin? Ordinarily, there would be all kinds of clear indicators, such as they are getting paid by the taxpayers. Whoops, we talked about that yesterday. Or whether they have a diplomatic passport. Whoops again. New emails being released between Doug Band, an executive at the Clinton Foundation, and Huma Abedin, who, of course, was deputy chief of staff to Hillary at the State Department. From Doug Band, quote, need to get me / Justy and JD diplomatic passports. We had them years ago, but they lapsed and we didn't bother getting them. From Huma. Okay, we'll figure it out. Then she goes into other things here. And so, as you point out in the jolt, the argument from the campaign is that this was a unique situation. You point out that it's a little murkier than that. But once again, it's just so hard to tell where one ends and the other begins.
Sure. And a couple of things here. One, federal regulations about who gets a diplomatic passport is pretty darn clear. You don't just get to hand them out all willy-nilly. You have to be a member of the Foreign Service or a family member, you know, diplomatic spouses, people like children, stuff like that. Or you're working on a U.S. government contract for the embassy, for the State Department in some capacity. In this case, it's really tough to say, oh, this is what they were doing. This, you know, this would qualify for Doug Band and these other people referred to. Now, it's important to note they didn't get the diplomatic passports. This was for the trip that Bill Clinton made to North Korea. This is when they had two journalists that were being detained by the North Korean regime. And it's a fairly familiar setup we've seen from hostile regimes throughout U.S. history. They take Americans hostage or charge them with espionage on some total BS charge, and then they effectively hold them hostage until they get what they want. And one of the things that Kim Jong-il wanted at that time was he really wanted a summit. He really wanted to be recognized the legitimate ruler of North Korea. He wanted respect. He's somebody important. You know, you can just kind of picture the angry small-time mobster fuming that he's being insulted. The Obama administration said, we're not going to do that. We're not giving you that. You may recall back during the Clinton years when we were sending all kinds of foreign aid to North Korea in, you know, in exchange for not continuing their nuclear program. Spoiler alert, they lied. Madeleine Albright went there and clinked glasses with Kim Jong-il. And, you know, all these little things that looked really bad in retrospect. That here we have one of the most maniacal and dangerous regimes in the world. And here we are clinking glasses with them and acting like everything's hunky-dory. Kim Jong-il wants that again. He's feeling neglected. He's feeling ignored. He wants it. And so the Obama administration said, we're not going to give you that. But they had Bill Clinton sitting around. He was this semi-president, right? He is this semi-envoy. Was it an official U.S. visit? No, not really. But Kim Jong-il got his nice photo op, and he got to greet the former American president at the airport. And he got, in his mind, the respect, and Bill Clinton left Korea with the two young women. They're saying, oh, so this excuses that. This explains why they're asking for the diplomatic passport. No, to me, this underlines why Bill Clinton blurred the lines between what was an official State Department operation and what was not. The Clinton Foundation was not quite this, because if you're a completely private organization and you have no ties to the U.S. government, there's no way you should be getting a diplomatic passport. But you might get it if you're part of the U.S. government, if you're part of the State Department. What were they on that particular trip to North Korea? Something in between. And this is what troubles people, is that there are strict rules on who can give money to the U.S. State Department. You can't just say, hi, State Department, here's a big suitcase full of cash. We'd like you to take it easy on us on our next human rights evaluation, right? That's bribery, right? You can't do that. But you can give as much money as you like to the Clinton Foundation because they're a private organization and they're not technically part of the U.S. government, even though we learned yesterday that they actually had, you know, some funding from the U.S. government because of the support that presidents traditionally get. This is kind of the heart of the problem of the Clinton Foundation, is that it's sort of a private organization and it's sort of a public organization, or seen as sort of this extra appendage of the federal government. And it's not supposed to be that. And you're not supposed to have these blurred areas. You're supposed to have clear lines of division. And there wasn't. And this is at the heart of it. The fact that the Clintons don't seem to see this problem here, I think, says a great deal about them.
Yes, it just keeps piling up. And I heard, I think it was James Rosen on the radio this morning saying, we're going to be hearing about newly released Clinton emails probably for the rest of our lives, certainly through the rest of this election season and in the years to come, particularly if she actually wins in November. So, Jim, on to a double-barreled crazy martini. It is back to school time. Some kids are already back in school. Some are about to go back. A lot of college students back on campus. We've got some bad news that's entirely predictable and some good news that you might not have expected. So let's start with the expected. This is courtesy of the College Fix, calling the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, that's the main campus, a place that values acceptance. The institution kicked off the fall semester with its newly installed chancellor, essentially telling new students that they should not say or do things that might be offensive or cause people to feel disrespected, calling the stance non-negotiable. We insist on a culture of respect, and we recognize that words and actions really matter, Chancellor Ronnie Green said during a speech on August 19th. Green did not define, neither in his speech nor the written policy underscoring it, what an action of disrespect might be, leaving it widely open to interpretation. He says, quote, we all share in the responsibility to create a positive culture here and to safeguard equity, inclusion, diversity, and respect. We take action when we observe something or someone being treated unfairly or in a demeaning manner. It's our core belief as a university here at the University of Nebraska. It's non-negotiable. That's who we are. But if you're looking for better news, Jim, we talked a lot about the insanity of the students basically running the asylum at the University of Missouri earlier this year, especially in the spring semester. And we've got some lovely news for people who are upset about that. This is a letter that went out from the Missouri Chancellor, Hank Foley, to the school staff on Wednesday. Quote, I am writing today to confirm that we project a very significant budget shortfall due to an unexpected sharp decline in first-year enrollments and student retention this coming fall. I wish I had better news. The anticipated declines, which total about 1,500 fewer students than current enrollment, in addition to a small number of necessary investments, are expected to leave us with an approximate $32 million budget gap for the next year. A smaller entering freshman class will have continuing impact on finances as they progress towards their degrees here. So, Jim, the Republican-controlled Missouri legislature decided not to increase funding for the university after the whole mess last year. And now it looks like there's actually parents and students paying attention and not wanting to be part of that anymore.
That code of conduct in the first part of this martini. You know, it kind of strikes me, Greg, that what we're seeing here is the traditional rules of social decorum that never needed to be written down, that were all just kind of the implied culture of a place like a university or institution of higher education, right? That you weren't supposed to go in and say, you're a butthead, you're stupid. You were just expected to treat people with a certain level of respect. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. In fact, I think that probably is a requirement for a learning environment. You can't just, you know, walk into the campus and start yelling at people. But where it started to bleed into was this idea that all of a sudden respect meant you could not say something that offended someone, even if the intent was not to be insulting or you know, derogatory or something like that. If you were to say, quote the Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama in 2008 and say that I think marriage is between a man and a woman, I remember how many Democrats denounced him then. Suddenly on a campus, you've committed a hate crime. All of a sudden, you've offended people, you have jarred them, you have made them feel oppressed, and they need a safe space and all that kind of stuff. Now, you hadn't said anything like, you know, I hate you, gay person, or you haven't used a slur or anything like that. And their effort was to use the rules of decorum, to use the rules that are kind of necessary of manners and politeness, something that was once socially enforced. If somebody was a jerk, you just simply wouldn't want to hang around with them. You wouldn't want to talk with them. And they want an official authority to say, no, we are going to come down on you like a ton of bricks. If you say something that offends someone, we will expel you from class. You will need to go to re-education, to counseling. We must take steps to drive this attitude out of you. And it really is kind of a bit of almost intriguing jujitsu on the part of the hard left, which used to be all about tearing down social institutions, all about being disrespectful. You're looking at the 60s protests and all that stuff. Now, all of a sudden, they want to use the power of the institution to drive contrary thoughts out of that. It's nice to see the University of Chicago making these steps that it did to push back against this. And look, you know, the consequences for the University of Missouri between this and the other report that a lot of small liberal arts colleges were finding themselves having much, you know, significant reductions in alumni donations. Look, universities only operate as long as there's somebody willing to pay for it. And if the parents start thinking this is a bad deal, if the students start thinking that the campuses have turned into you know, an asylum where the inmates run it and there's no sense of control, and basically, you know, there was some university protesters said, you president, who said, look, if you attempt to shut down a building, if you attempt to impede people from doing their jobs, you're going to get arrested. You can't do that anywhere else. And the campus is not a special place where the law doesn't apply. And you can just imagine that coming across as a slap to the face to the average campus activist. But, you know, maybe that is part of the education process, Greg, that, you know, college is where you stop being a kid. You're now 18. You're now an adult in the eyes of the law. And you should start accepting the consequences of their actions. And one of the things that's fascinating about what we see on campuses in these recent years, Greg, is this, like, Greg, when you were in college, did you ever think that a professor, like, would have to be punished if they offended you?
No, never crossed my mind.
Professor, I'm sorry. What you just said just offended me. Like, so what?
Yeah, you raise your hand. You raise your hand. You engage in the debate. That's what it's all about.
Or I'll flunk you, right? Shut up. Shut up and keep taking notes. Just kind of a baffling sense of entitlement here. It is kind of intriguing and perhaps a hopeful sign that we see consequences on the University of Missouri, and maybe other universities can look at this and say, okay, we don't want to turn into that. So we're going to have to keep an environment where there isn't this sense of a politically correct thought police, and angry students may take over the campus at any given moment.
Jim, I can't tell you how much this pains me, but you referred to the dean who told the students that if they stayed occupying the building, that they would be arrested. That was Ohio State University. I must give credit to the administration of Ohio State University for taking that stand.
Wait, what school was that again, Greg?
I'm sorry, it was the Ohio
State
University.
I was about to say, if you do it, the giant acorn or buckeye just jumps out from behind a tree and throws things at you. So, yes, it is the Ohio State University, as we learn every time there's the introduction to the players in Monday Night Football.
Beware of the menacing flowering nut because, you know, you never know when that's going to strike. That's what a buckeye is. That's their mascot. It's a flowering nut. Really tough. All right, Jim, on that note, have a great weekend. I will actually be out next week. Rich McFadden will be in for me, but you and I will reconvene in a little over a week.
Enjoy your break, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Tuesday when Rich and Jim will be here for the next edition of the 3 Martini Lunch. Have a great Labor Day weekend, everyone.